already overworked colleagues. I'm sure that your absence from the north is greatly appreciated. But anyway, we're Math Jarrow and the bones of the Northumbrian landscape.
Thanks very much, Alex. If I speak at this level, am I loud? Am I shouting at you? Or is this acceptable? Good at the back? Right, excellent. Okay. Right, good. First thing then, I must acknowledge that I'm influenced, helped, worked together with quite a lot of people on related projects, particularly Wymouth Jarrow with my friend Sarah Semple at Durham and Alex Turner at Newcastle, and then there's a whole gang of other people who've been working on our project there, and I shall introduce little bits of results from that work in this talk. I've also been working with Tomás Carrigón at Cork, and I'll come back a little bit to that at the end, because there's a nice conference in September that you may find interesting, and I shall put up a poster. And also my friend Chris Fowler, who works at Newcastle. He's a prehistorian, so most of you won't have heard of him, but he works on the Neolithic and the Bronze Age, and he's very interested in the theoretical aspects of the things that we're going to be looking at. Now, a very helpful supervisor, well-meaning no doubt, once told me that a 20-minute paper was a one-idea paper. So 20 minutes we have. Unfortunately, the organisers have rather unwisely given me a 45-minute slot for a 20-minute paper. But I will do my best to limit the going on. Also, you know, this is a colloquium, it's reasonably informal, I hope. These are not finished ideas that I'm presenting to you. These are ideas which are just sort of bubbling away a little bit, and they may be a little bit different, perhaps, to some of the things that we've heard already, although actually they impinge on many, many of the same topics. So, one idea paper, my idea that I'm trying to talk about is this. Wouldn't it be interesting, useful, productive, if for the 7th century we could really get to grips with what happens on the ground in terms of the practicalities when we're looking at how conversion to Christianity is practically enacted? What I want to look at is, you know, what were the mechanisms by which people were convinced to change to Christianity? How were benefits delivered to people, particularly people who are wielding power? So I'm going to try and work in that general direction whilst I'm speaking to you. What I need to do, though, is to introduce the point of view that I'm coming from. And if you'll bear with me, I have 3 or 4 slides which should enable me to do that. So, we are all familiar with the idea that early medieval and slightly later medieval monasteries are founded in unpleasant, difficult places. We're also familiar with the idea that they, generally speaking, aren't. All of these ones, for example, are found on the sites of Roman villas in well-farmed, well-warmed soils that have been used for probably several thousand years. Now, what we are looking at here is the difference between the material reality of a place and the perception of the place. I'm not trying to create a false opposition between those two, and I shall talk in the slide after next a little bit about that. But it's worth saying that this idea of perception has become increasingly important, both in scholarly discourse, particularly in cultural geography in the last 40 years or so, but also in the world of policy. So we have things like the European Landscape Convention, which is guiding how governments manage landscapes across Europe today, which defines landscape as an area as perceived by people, okay, whose character is the result of the action and interaction of natural and or human factors. But there is a strong emphasis on this idea of perception as being an important element. Now, perception has often been opposed to the material or to materiality. You may be familiar with works of sort of archaeological works looking at phenomenologies of landscapes, like Chris Tilley's work on Bodmin Moor, which is what this slide comes from here. And in our disciplines, we have a sort of a fundamental divide, or rather, I should say, we have had a divide between those who focus on the perceptual aspects of landscapes and those who focus on the material aspects of landscapes. In the first camp, we've got, since the 1970s, early 1970s, cultural geographers who are much more interested in perception of landscape, the formation of images in the minds, the eyes of the viewer. In the other camp, the material camp, we've got people like traditional historical geographers or landscape historians in England in particular. I'm thinking of people, you know, like the Leicester School of Landscape Historians, have produced some good examples. Now, these two different groups have been dealing with quite similar topics, but they had got to the point where they can't really talk to each other because they use completely different vocabularies, they come from completely different scholarly backgrounds. Which I think is a problem for us, because fundamentally we must understand how people are perceiving landscapes in the past if we want to understand the kind of material changes that they are making to those landscapes. Happily, recently there's been in cultural geography what's sometimes called a material turn, which has been prompted by various things, for example the environmental crisis, and also interest in practice and in practical action. I'm thinking of things like Nigel Thrift's non-representational theory, which is non-representational because it's thinking about material objects rather than ideas about objects or perceptions of them. So here we have a nice example from Bede about practice and how practice re-inscribes ideas of landscape. Often as he went about the monastery on business, he, the abbot, would come across the brethren at work and would quickly go and help them out in whatever they were doing, putting his hand to the plough along the furrow, hammering iron into shape, or wielding the winnowing fan, actively working in the landscape. Now, this growing emphasis on material and materiality is obviously very appealing to archaeologists, who in some ways have felt a bit out in the cold with the kind of cultural geography tradition that was developing, because it was moving away from empirical work on physical things. Archaeologists, of course, like working, or have to work, with physical things, real things. And they like to study the relationships between material things and people. And recent theoretical developments in archaeology have been looking increasingly at the ways that things, people, animals and places are related to one another, the kinds of relationships that they have between each other. And people have begun to use the idea of entanglement to help explain these kinds of relationships. Now, the slide encapsulates one such entanglement or relationship or string of relationships. So we have the land of the monastery. You can imagine this being North Pennine somewhere. It's not actually, but we'll say that it is. Some cows, okay. Cows, of course, grazing the land of the monastery, very important as a form of property, but also in the Christian period, cows are turned into books. So they're fundamental for the work of the monastery. Books are turned into £4.7 million or whatever it was that was recently paid for. So these strings of relationships go from the past right through to the present, okay, right through to us today. And our historiographies are entangled with the doings of people in the past. One of the interesting things about this work on material objects and materiality is that there's a realization that the material things themselves, the perception of them, changes depending on the context. So we can perceive things in different ways at different times, even though they're the same things, and we understand the chains of relationships that make those physical objects that we're dealing with, perhaps in different ways. Now, like all good ideas, this has got nothing to do with me, but has been worked on by various archaeologists over the last few years. This is a selection of books that have been published in the last 2 months, rather irritatingly, on the subject. So we have the big guns coming out, Ian Hodder producing a book called Entangled, and Michael Shanks with The Archaeological Imagination, which deals with similar topics. You know, these are the guys who have all gone to California from here. Gavin Lucas, also formerly here, but now in Iceland. the understanding the archaeological record, where he uses these same ideas about relationships between things. This kind of work draws a lot on thinking about networks, meshworks, relationships that's important in science and technology studies. So Bruno Latour, Gilles Deleuze, those kind of social science thinkers. And it's been, you know, really popularized in archaeology recently. Okay. Good. So, that's by way of introduction. Now, in some historiography on the subject, there's a view of 7th century England where Christian conversion, the change of belief, is the primary agent in the transformation of society and the changing of social relationships. This, I don't find this very satisfactory as a way of explaining what really changed on the ground, what really happened. Okay, Seller and Yateman clearly in the 30s thought it was a bit daft as well, hence the charming slide. So back to my idea, my topic. What I want to find out, or think about rather, is how and why did beliefs make people change what they did, and how did they change social relationships? So for example, do we really think that monasteries were established on the initiative of monks? Why was it that King Egfrith granted that land to Wearmouth and Jarrow, really those huge estates in the mouth of the rivers Tyne and Wear? Was it really because he was impressed with Benedict Bishop? That's what Bede tells us. Seems to me unlikely that those were the reasons that Egfrith made those huge donations. Egfrith, of course, was someone, you know, who could quite happily lead a huge army against the Picts, and a month after the dedication of St. Paul's Church at Jarrow, he was lying dead on the Pictish battlefield at Nectonsmere. So I think being impressed with priests is for their virtue or holiness is unlikely to have been the prime motivator lying behind his actions. So what really happened on the ground? Well, what I'm going to try and think about briefly is what we could call the technologies of Christianity. And I've picked just four small examples here of different kinds of technologies, and they are familiar to all of you, of course. The parceling and division of landscape, whether as property or the enclosure of sites, boundaries and so on. Writing, building in stone. In Northumbria we have wonderful evidence for this. And burial and relics and sainthood. So I'll try and move in the direction of why these things appeal to the people who were wielding power in the 7th century, and also how they related to existing strategies and existing changes in society. And that's something which came up earlier as well. So I'll move on now to look at these four examples briefly in turn. The first one then is landscape, or the parceling of landscape. Now Brian Roberts, Professor Brian Roberts of Durham University, has argued that Wearmouth and Jarrow are located in liminal or boundary positions between core areas of settlement in the Northumbrian kingdoms. I don't find this a convincing argument, I have to tell you. We'll look at why I think that is, but this is just a map of place names made by Mark Wood, for his PhD thesis and in a recent publication, of Anglo-Saxon place names, and he's used old methodologies, really, to try and look at which of the place names of this region, Durham and Northumberland, may belong to the Middle Saxon period. And his map, whatever the difficulties of working with this material, suggests strongly both that there is a river in focus for these early sites and place names, and also that the area of Wearmouth and Jarrow, which is here, this is the River Tyne, this is the River Weir, is a focus for early settlement, early in the Middle Ages, okay? Rather than being what Roberts describes it as a kind of remote wedge of woodland. There isn't really much other evidence to support Roberts's suggestion, and in fact some recent pollen work that we've done around the site at Wearmouth also doesn't support his suggestion, but there are some nice oak trees growing in the area, which have disappeared later. So, this region then appears to be inhabited in the 7th century, and we know also that it is inhabited from prehistory onwards. The earliest prehistoric site we have near Wearmouth is a Neolithic enclosure site, which is just about here, and there's obviously a well-established history of Roman settlement in the area also. Now, my contention is that in terms of landscape, what the role that the churches, the establishment of churches performs here, is to ossify this landscape and to help to fix it, to give it permanence and stability. So I think monasteries play a key role in this fixing of the landscape. And, for example, we can see a string of them along the Tyne Valley. These dots represent monasteries of Hexham, Corbridge, Bywell, and Jarrow, and Tynemouth along the River Tyne there, you know, not very far apart in many cases, just 3 or 4 kilometres, some of them. But I think they provide a sort of key stability in the emerging landscape of the early Middle Ages. This is a landscape, of course, which has been relatively fluid up until the middle of the 6th century, around that time. We can try and use some other methods to look at the kind of landscape the two sites are established in. So this is our study area for our project around our project around Wearmouth and Jarrow. You can see the two sites. Wearmouth is down here and Jarrow is up there. Now this is Brian Roberts' own analysis from his Durham Heaths project of the distribution of fields and enclosures in the later medieval period, with the yellow representing heath and the green representing field. So even that shows that the monasteries were sited, you know, within areas of core arable land. Actually, I think we can go a bit further than him, because he didn't use various types of evidence, including evidence for a medieval ridge and furrow, which is represented by the green and the red over here. It's quite hard to reconstruct the medieval field pattern in this area, partly because this whole area is now urban. It's all city, apart from, you know, a kilometre band of fields, which makes kind of an L shape here. It's all urbanised, but also it was enclosed in the 17th century, and the areas of heathland were enclosed at a close time to the areas of medieval fields. So the patterns are a little bit hard to unpick, even on the early maps. This is the first edition of the map from the 1860s, which is underlying this. But I think we can say that in common with the other monasteries along the Tyne Valley, the other monasteries along the Wear Valley, these monasteries are established in good agricultural land in the early Middle Ages, which has been used for many hundreds or thousands of years. This kind of fixity, if you like, increasing stability is also visible in terms of Anglo-Saxon settlements at the time. We have typically 5th and 6th century settlements like these, which are excavated by Clive Waddington up in north of Northumberland, Cheviot Quarry, and there's more at Lantern Quarry. These are small settlements with occasional scattered buildings which are not rebuilt on the same sites, don't appear to have boundaries defining areas, limits within the settlement. That changes, and that changes from the middle of the 6th century, so before the conversion to Christianity. But after that period, we begin to get increasing boundedness within occupation sites, increasing stability of settlements. So this is a fantastic place which has been recently excavated by Tyne and Wear Museum's archaeology, called Shotton, just north of Newcastle. It's occupied from the late 6th through to probably the 10th century, and at some point settlement moves. You can see these, you can probably just about see these yellow boundaries marked on here. Mark moves to medieval Shotton, which is over here, which is occupied from the late 11th or 12th century. We're not totally certain. One of the annoying things about Northumbria is that there is no early medieval pottery to speak of. There are actually, I think, 8 shards of pottery from this site, so that's 8 shards for 500 years, which is not a very good proportion. By contrast, over here, it was occupied for sort of 300 years, there are 14,000 shards or something ridiculous. So pottery is not much use to us in defining where settlements are. But again, from the 7th century here, we see increasing stability in this settlement. And I think that this is something which starts before the conversion to Christianity, but it's something that the establishment of monasteries as bounded sites contributes to fixing as the way of establishing royal centres and other kinds of settlements. The boundaries around the sites of Wearmouth and Jarrow have been rather hard to identify hitherto, though we think we may have made a small contribution to working out where they were. You can see that's a topographical model of the site of Jarrow. The arrow points to where St Paul's Church is, which is there. There's this little river, Don, which comes and flows into Jarrow's Slake, so it's kind of on a natural promontory, the site. But no one has been able to identify a boundary to the north, but we think we may have been able to do this with a geophysical survey. Actually, you can just about see a bit of a dip on that model, just the other side of the church. So the church seems to be standing in on a little promontory that sticks out into the marshland. This area shows a potentially large sort of wet, boggy area, maybe 10 or 20 metres wide, defining the inner limits of the monastery on a promontory. At Wearmouth, it's even more difficult, because the whole area has been heavily urbanised since the early 18th century. This is a very early 19th century map of the area. The church is there. So you can see these are all shipyards and other industrial workings here. This is the area as it is today, with Sunderland University's St Peter's campus at the top, and you know, 1960s housing developments below. It was all cleared in the 60s of terraced housing and so on, and blocks of flats built instead. But as part of the project, Museum of London Archaeology have done some geoarchaeological work with coring to identify ancient ground surfaces. This interpretive map is the result of that, and also the diagram above. So you can see St Peter's Church here, and it too stands on a kind of promontory which sticks out into the estuary of the River Wear. And they identified a stream to the west of the site, which may form a sort of western boundary to the precinct. Great stuff, this, because they got in their cores actual material that was dated by radiocarbon to the 7th century, I mean, centering on the 7th century. So we know this is the real land surface around the time of the monastery. So, you know, that was quite interesting. So, a second technology, writing. We've heard a lot about writing, and of course it is fundamental, foundational to the granting of land and the fixing of property and the emergence of new ideas about property, an idea that was obviously clearly appreciated by later forgers of charters. But we find it also represented in the narrative sources for Northumbria. We know about Wearmouth and Jarrow's endowment because we hear about it from Bede, and we hear about it later from Simeon of Durham in his very early 12th century accounts. Now, Bede's record shows us that this was a royal endowment from King Egfrith, both for Wearmouth in the 670s and for Jarrow in the 680s. And there are various interesting things about this establishment of this monastery, one of which is, of course, Bede's concern to make sure he notes or puts into the mouth of Benedict Bishop that Benedict Bishop's brother is not to get his hands on the monastery after the death of Benedict Bishop. But that's by the by, that's incidental. Ian Wood has pointed out, of course, that Bede's idea, or Bede's version of the story about this being one monastery in two places, has remained with us and fixed right up, if you like, to the present day, because this is generally still the conception, the popular conception of the houses of Wearmouth Jarrow, that they were one monastery. Wood, by contrast, argues that this may not always have been the case, and he adduces as evidence of this the foundation stone of Jarrow, which survives in the church of Jarrow, which shows that the basilica there was dedicated a month before the death of Egfrith, and doesn't mention Benedict Bishop at all. Okay, only mentions Egfrith and Chalfrith as the abbot church. So that's something that's interesting. We've got one kind of writing on stone being superseded, if you like, in the story by the writings of Bede, which became much more important later. Remaining with the theme of writing on stone and building materials, I think this is another key technology of early Christianity in Northumbria, at least. Previously, building is in wood. There are no stone buildings in Northumbria before the mid-7th century, when we start to have buildings like York Minster, Wilfrid's churches at Ripon and Hexham, and of course the churches at Wearmouth and Jarrow, which in parts still survive, as we'll see in a moment. Before that, in the 5th and 6th centuries, as we said before, buildings were in wood. They were often frequently replaced, not rebuilt on the same site, but built slightly further away. In the 7th century, as we see famously at Yeavering, buildings are replaced on the same site. So again, we've got this process of becoming fixed, beginning to happen probably before the conversion to Christianity. Certainly that's the case also in the, I think, in the southern, in the evidence from southern English excavations. But what I think the technology of building in stone allows to happen is for that to be really established as the norm. So the churches in stone, as Eskham in County Durham, perhaps, well, probably dating to the same era, create a new kind of permanence in the landscape, even though they too would have needed maintaining and could be replaced and altered, just like wooden buildings. Now, we've been doing some work at Wearmouth and Jarrow on this aspect. Also, these are laser scans of the porch at Wearmouth. These show some really interesting little, but by the by, I can't resist mentioning some little snippets, which also hint that the two monasteries are not founded as one monastery in two places, but they're quite different. So the building material of Wearmouth is generally different to the building material of Jarrow. Most obviously, Wearmouth, we realise, contains freshly quarried stone for building the porch, whereas Jarrow, what we have of it surviving, is built from recycled Roman blocks. Now, there are recycled Roman stones here as well, here at Wearmouth. And I think this reuse of Roman masonry, this is a really clear and explicit example of the kind of ideological links, the ideological relationships that the material of the stone itself encapsulates and that people would have understood in the 7th century. So here we have our models of the two churches. So this is a point cloud from laser scans of the church at Wearmouth. And this is a model, a 3D model that's derived from the point cloud for Jarrow. And these enable us to look at the relationships between different bits of fabric in the buildings with considerable degree of flexibility, because we can move in and out of the buildings and look at how different bits relate to each other much more easily than we can by climbing up and down ladders in the church, for example. Peter Brown suggests in his famous book on the rise of Western Christendom that the monastic founders, or the people who are building these churches, the kings like Edgeworth, are not harking back to a lost Rome, but they are building Rome, they are making it now, in reality, on their doorsteps. And I think it's highly significant that the material, the actual fabric that these churches are built from, is given to the church builders by the kings from their sites at South Shields. So both Wearmouth and Jarrow contain material from both South Shields and Wall's End Roman forts. And we know, we're almost certain that South Shields was a royal vill in the Middle Saxon period, and we certainly know that both sites were used for burial in the 6th century. And in the case of South Shields, a bit later. So there's a strong kind of relationship, a link between kings who are giving the land and the kings who are giving the actual building material from their own property to build these churches on the mouths of the two rivers. We found that there are complete Roman features built into the churches here. So some of the arches, for example, at Jarrow and at Wearmouth have been brought from either Wall's End or South Shields. And the church has been fashioned from existing Roman architecture, if you like, built around that existing Roman architecture. This is the tower at Wearmouth. Of course, the original porch of the church, in the 7th century church, probably finished just there with this, what was probably a large life-size sculpture of a person. Of course, we don't know who it was. Perhaps we can speculate. St. Peter, at the front of the tower, built then with, you know, framed around these arches and so on, which came from the Roman sites. And this same strategy is used elsewhere. Wilfrid's Hexham, using material from Corbridge and other sites, and Bywell along the Tyne Valley, using what appear to be Roman toilet seats in the very top. A sound hole in the very top tier of the tower. I guess this is probably Saxo-Norman. This is a serious suggestion. I mean, you know, there's lots of these Roman toilet seats in this part of the world, so could well be that that's true. But there we are. So finally, my final technology is burial, and this is brief burial and relics. Now, what I was thinking about was how this relationship changed between burials and social relations from the early Saxon period through to the Middle Saxon period. And it occurs to me that in the early Anglo-Saxon period, the memory is created in the act and the ritual of the burial or the cremation. When the burial goes into the ground in the cemetery, that's more or less the end of the deceased. They don't act later in society. Now, this begins to change also before the conversion to Christianity, because in the late 6th and the early 7th century, we begin to see burials that seem to be becoming more active in the Anglo-Saxon landscape. So we get barrow burials that appear to be placed on boundaries of one kind or another, whether they're the boundaries of kingdoms, perhaps in Wessex or Sussex, or whether they're the boundaries of emerging geographical or administrative units, as I have previously suggested. Whatever the case, these burials seem to be becoming more active. This is one from Capheaton in Northumberland, and this is the mighty East Bolton Buckle, which is about that big. But nevertheless, it is a 7th century gilt buckle with garnets in it. I'm getting excited because we don't have a great deal of this kind of material from our part of the world. But it was found in the 19th century, supposedly in a stone sepulchre in East Bolton, which lies between the territories of Jarrow and Wearmouth. It's very interesting because this central swathe of land, as far as we can tell from the sources, never belonged to either of the two monasteries. It later belonged to the Bishop of Durham, as they did belong to the Prior of Durham. But it seems that it never belongs to two monasteries. So perhaps here we've got a burial which is being used to define land, emerging land units as well. But of course, later on in the conversion period, we have the use of the dead as active members of the community. So they're still, you know, dead bones in the landscape. So once they were live bones, so here's Eostorin again. Often, as he went about monitoring, we read this before, so he was doing his work in the landscape. And then he dies, of course. And what happens to him? Whitbert wisely sought to remove the bones of Abbot Eostorin, which had been placed in the porch at the entrance to St. Peter's, and also those of Abbot Siegfried. Both sets of bones placed in one casket divided by a partition inside, and put them to rest within the church next to the body of Benedict. These are the bones of saints and founders, which in the early Christian period are active members of the community. So they're the same material, okay, but they have a different kind of materiality that has shifted in the early Christian period. They are perceived as working in different ways in the landscape. Now, okay, I'm no doubt running over my time allotment, which means you'll be able to ask me fewer questions. But nevertheless, I'm just summing up now by saying, I think that these technologies of early Christianity appealed to people like Edgefrith, or Chaldwulf a bit later, or Edwin potentially, because they could use them they saw how they could use them to develop things which were already beginning to happen. So the materiality of stone, of bones, of the landscape itself was fundamentally changed by the ideology of Christianity, and that enabled people like the kings of Northumbria to capitalise on these technologies and increase their ability to exercise control over their kingdoms. We often hear that kings like Christianity because it allowed them to, you know, to enhance their prestige. The question is, how did it allow them to enhance their prestige? And that is what I hope I've begun to try and answer in this talk. So that by the 9th century, we won't go on to the Vikings, but they're also a whole different kettle of fish in this part of the world. By the 9th century, we've got what you might see as a kind of Anglo-Saxon Valley of the Kings, if you like. Did you call them that phrase? Is that your idea? No, somebody, it wasn't me either, that's also not my idea, but I quite like this idea of an Anglo-Saxon Valley of the Kings, like the Tyne, which is comparable to the other valleys, like the Thames Valley or the Wiltshire Avon Valley in the south of England, with monasteries dotted along it and royal villas dotted along it too. Good, right, you'll be delighted to hear that that's the end. Thanks to my collaborators. Just before I finish, I should advertise, I promised Tomas that I would advertise, a conference that we are having in Cork in September, which possibly, if I click on this link, a poster will appear. Hold on. Funded by, I should say, funded by various people, the Heritage Council and the University College Cork and the University of Newcastle. Where's it gone? Hang on. Aha! Here it is. There you go, look at that. So I'm feeling guilty because I was meant to bring posters or flyers with me and I forgot. But here are, you can see there's some great speakers such as Nancy Edwards and others. Tomas, Elizabeth Laurent, we have Elizabeth Zadora Rio. We have, go away, little thing. Yours truly, and various others. And if you would like to come, we would, of course, be delighted to see you there. Thank you for your attention.